Science Faction is only for adults and children cool enough to leave an iTunes comment.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science. Comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 314. Science Faction, the origin of religion.
A religion podcast? Did Ken Ham finally get to you? It's good to see you there, Lord of my preachers, finally going to you, Mr. Timothy.
Straight from New Zealand, Ken Ham, have you come to talk to us about religion?
Well, after that victory I had against Bill Nye, the science guy, a few years ago, I've used it as a springboard to evangelize. Clearly, I've caught a Jesus fish, and it looks like Robert Timothy.
I would love to get different types of crazy people in the same room for a big, like, public forum. Like, it would be Ken Ham sitting next to Alex Jones, and both of them screaming nonsense at each other, and then walking away feeling that they won the conversation.
They're crazy in different ways. One of them's crazy in a much more publicly acceptable way. Like, apparently, you could be crazy for Jesus and nobody.
Employable. He's still kind of seen as crazy, though, so it still kind of works.
You could be elected to Congress in some of our shittier states and believe exactly what Ken Ham believes. True for Alex Jones as well.
Yes, absolutely.
That's fewer states, though.
And speaking of Alex Jones, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how you doing this afternoon?
Maybe I'll be bringing out some Alex Jones, who's a real red-blooded American. And he will fight you.
And speaking of a red-blooded American, our science guest host for the afternoon, Connor. Connor, how you doing?
Doing okay. I think I was smote or smited or smitten, whatever the word is. Losing my voice a bit, but glad to be here.
Yes, you sound like you've got a nice raspiness to you. Like, you might do some side work on, like, a phone sex line?
Oh, yeah. It's a good side gig, yeah.
You had a real red-blooded American voice that doesn't back down, then you wouldn't be having this problem here, Connor.
And by the way, I think you got the wrong verb there. Smitten is actually how Damian feels about Alex Jones.
I just can't believe we have him, Ken Ham, and Connor in studio today. This is going to be a wonderful show.
And those of you who are wondering, why are you guys doing the intro before the intro bit? You guys usually do the intro bit, and then you go into your intros. Why are you doing that?
Because this is actually Science Faction, the origin of introductions.
No, I got some feedback from a guy I met at an archaeology conference, actually, who's also an avid podcaster, Chris Webster, who runs the CRM podcast and the Archaeology Podcast Network. And he's like, hey, I dig your show, but your intros are like 25 minutes into the thing, and I have no idea who the fuck I'm listening to. Maybe you want to put that at the very beginning. And I was like, you know what? That's good feedback. So, by the way, if you guys have feedback like that or concerning Damien's failure to try it, I call BS, please send that at Faction Science.
What your friend doesn't know is that we do that for a reason, because we say a lot of our most offensive material at the top.
Right.
And we hope the people who would report us would tune out by the 30 minutes into the episode.
Yeah, it's a lot of self...
Can't be identified, yeah.
It's a lot of self-selection of, like, oh, fuck these guys. And then they never know our name to associate with the fuck these guys idea.
Yeah, that abortion joke had a fucking reason.
And if you guys want to hear more abortion jokes, go ahead and check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com. And if you want to hear some of those in person, come on out to Nerd Night. The next one being Tuesday, April 2nd, which is 2 days after this gets published. It will be at 32 North Brewing at 6:30 p.m. It is the best of Nerd Night, meaning we're going to have the best speakers of all of 2018's Nerd Nights. And for those of you guys who haven't heard of Nerd Night before, it's a national program whereby local scientists come out and they give TED Talk-like talks, but in a place where you can drink booze and have fun, and we have trivia. It's just a real fun, nerdy time, and I am the new host of that. I'm incredibly excited about it, so please come on out. Those of you guys who have listened before know that if you come out to Nerd Night this Tuesday, April 2nd, and you come up and tell me why it is that you hate Damien's refusal to play I Call BS like a serious game, tell me what your specific reason is for hating that about Damien, and you will get free Science Faction merch.
If you're willing to see Bobby, go up to him and stand up to Bobby for me. Mm-hmm. I will kill somebody you want to be killed, or I will fellate you. Your call.
Damien, would you do us all a favor and kill the Damien who refuses to win I Call BS? Could you kill that character and just come back as somebody who actually tries?
Fillet yourself, you know.
Yeah, either way. You got to get those ribs taken out, Marilyn Manson style.
I already did. It doesn't help.
I'm just not flexible.
It's in recovery time.
I heard he got a rib taken out. I got six just to make sure. Yeah. No good.
It is very hard to sit up straight right now.
Also, don't punch me. I'll die.
Anybody want to feel a lung? All right, and we know that there's two types of nerds out there. There's the science nerds who are really successful, then there's the mom's basement nerds. Well, I'm doing a podcast for the mom's basement nerds. By the time this episode comes out, the first episode will have aired, but I am doing a live play Dungeons & Dragons podcast. It's called Awful Neutral. Please check it out. We release Tuesdays. Give us a 5-star review and comment if you like what you hear.
I mean, listen, just so you guys know, Damien actually asked me, hey, Bobby, do you want to come on this podcast? And I went, Damien, I do comedy for nerds. I run two nerd show podcasts every single week, and this is too nerdy for me.
He refuses. So my dream for this Awful Neutral podcast is for it to get so big that he's begging for an invitation.
Won't happen. That won't happen. I will be like that ghetto gangster who just accepts that he's going to be shot in the head. I will not beg for my life. I will sit there and take that bullet like a man. All right, so on to the origins of religion. So first off, you are probably wondering, wait a second, you're a science podcast. You usually do in your origins bit the origins of the universe or the origins of stars or something like that. Why would you talk about the origins of religion? That seems like the opposite of science.
Because of our new sponsor, Vatican Radio.
I thought you were going to say Ken Ham.
Ken Ham probably could buy and sell this podcast.
That's absolutely true. He's bought and sold a fucking ark.
Wait, didn't that go bankrupt?
No. They just got the public to subsidize their religious project. But no, so why would we talk about the origins of religion? Well, one is religion is a very important part of human culture and human history. And so you kind of can't really separate those things out, and that becomes a part of the story of who we are. But second, it's also part of psychology and what we believe and how we believe. Lastly, if you think about it, there's a lot of conflicts between religion and science that end up affecting both of those, usually negatively, in such a way that it is a necessary part of every person's life, at least if you're in the United States. Like, I feel like if you're in parts of Scandinavia, you probably don't give a shit. But, like, if you're in the United States, you have to understand what religion is and how it affects people if you want to be involved in any social endeavor, including something like science, because it has such an impact. And we all know that from things like creationism and flat earth and anti-vaccine stuff, all of which is linked to certain religious beliefs. So that is why we are talking about it today.
Wait, flat earth is linked to religious? I know they're very anti-Semitic.
Yes. No. Most flat earthers, so this comes back from my research from the flat earth debate, most flat earthers get their views from being very staunchly biblical literalist. And the Bible does say in numerous places that, or insinuates that the earth is flat. And so they get it from that.
Now, I know you said in your research that that's from the 18th century, some weird interpretation of the Bible.
Yes.
That from an American, and I'm sorry, in the 19th century.
Yeah.
So the guy you debated against was an outlier, like, because he didn't seem like the type. He seemed like the crazy conspiracy, Alex Jones type.
He is an outlier. He's one of the few non-Christian flat earthers.
So most flat earthers aren't the Alex Jones type? They're Ken Hams?
There are many more very strongly. And by the way, Alex Jones, strongly Christian religious guy. So like,
he's a red-blooded American. You have to understand it, a hero.
Well, so first of all, to have this discussion, we have to start off with, what do you guys think religion is? So what is religion? If you were to try and sum it up, and let's say an alien showed up on Earth and you had to explain to them what this thing called religion was.
Now, am I defining it as I would, like, what separates a cult from a religion? Because, I mean, one person just believing something could be a religion.
Yeah, so put those together. What would you describe something in that religious context as being?
I think of it usually, something that's more faith-based, that you're not asking for the evidence necessarily. You're supposed to just take something at face value. You know, usually something to give a little bit more meaning to life, either what happens before or after.
Good. So think of it almost in the same way you would think about philosophy, right? So it has to be something that explains the nature of the universe, usually, though not always, the origins of such as well. Usually give some kind of indications and directions for life ways and how you should live and what things you should prioritize, and then also what is expected of you, right? In some cases by a deity or nature or whatever. But we all understand religion as being part of a practice. So it's usually not just something somebody has in their head like they would a philosophy. It also has some elements of practice to it, and those are usually enshrined in some kind of rituals. So with that as kind of a very broad, obviously, background, how can we tell when this formed? How do we know about what the origins of religion are, and what clues can we look for? So we could ask ourselves, what are some of the earliest indications? So let's go back in time. Obviously, the ancient Greeks had a religion, right? And we understand their gods. We know what they thought. They actually wrote down a lot of what they thought. They had statues. They had artwork. We can say the Greeks had this religion. Take another step back. We know the ancient Egyptians, even before them, very similar, also wrote down stuff, also had a pantheon of gods, also had stories and artwork depicting them.
I don't know how related this is, but we talked about Greeks and their artwork.
Mm-hmm.
They had statues. We can all admit that Greek statues have small penises.
Yes.
They made them naked Now, do you think that very skilled artisans over time just should, like, every invading army that would come in would just take a little bit off the penis?
And just to make themselves look better
just
every
to
time?
Shit on the Greeks? Like, that was... you didn't pay your bill. All right, I'll take some dick off of your statue.
I like the idea that every army, they have, like, fighters, cavalrymen, artillery, the bannermen, and then one dude with a chisel and a hammer whose entire job it is to emasculate your statues. And he's really good, too, because he has to make it look natural. So, like, he has good weathering technique that he, like, sandpaper. He does that trick where you pour lime juice on the paper to make it look old.
I like the general's explaining, you need an army to win a war, but you need a skilled craftsman to truly emasculate a people.
So we have at least back to then. We know we can go back even further to Mesopotamia. Same thing. We have the gods that are represented there. But we can go back even further. So in early Turkish towns like Çatalhöyük, you know, 7,000 or so BC, we can see that we have towns centralized around common themes, artwork, things that we can would consider religious representations. We go back even further, Göbekli Tepe, 10,000 or so. We see that there are stylized sculptures in 3D form on a lot of their artwork, and the alignment of the structure itself seems to have some kind of inherent spiritual significance. The place seems to be a gathering place of these people. So that is an indication that there is likely some kind of religious, something we would call a religious type belief going on. Stretch back even further, going back at least 25, 30,000 years ago, we see these figurines all through Europe and parts of Eurasia, which are essentially very, I'm going to say attractive. Some people might say rotund women. We call these the Venus figurines. So Venus of Willendorf and a few others. And they're basically very full-figured ladies with accentuated butts, stomach, and breasts.
Well, I mean, we just think it's weird you masturbate to these statues.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we can say that there are some full-figured women out there who are very attractive. But this is a weird fetish, Bobby.
Well, here's what's funny. So their faces are also like not faces, like they don't have regular human faces. They have like cross hatching for faces. And so it's really weird because we're not sure what that means. Is this like a goddess symbol? Does this mean this is something that was worshipped? Is this believed to be part of a deity? Or, and this is one of the arguments too, this is just Paleolithic porn. You don't have YouPorn yet, and so you just like hold this little clay figurine.
I no need to find rock that look like boob. I carve boobs into rock.
Yeah, and by the way, so this some of these are like 25,000 years old or something. Some of the earliest clay pots and stuff aren't until Japan has some of the earliest ones at like 10,000 years old. So for the vast majority of the history of ceramics, they're just used as porn. They're not used for dishes or pottery or water jugs.
I think it'd be hilarious if you go back in time and you picture like a Stone Age mother going into her son's room and like going, checking under his bed, his bed of leaves, and finding these little figurines. How do I talk to him about pornography?
We can go back even further than that. Lascaux Caves and a few other very detailed cave drawings at around 40,000 years ago have what we think are actually like almost motion animation. Like if you're in this cave with a flickering light, you will see these things almost moving. We can imagine this being a very religious or spiritual type experience. Go back even further than that, and 100,000 years ago or so in the Levant area, we have our own species, Homo sapien, being buried with red ochre spread across the remains and given grave goods, so either tools or, in one case, it's like the jawbone of a specific animal is laid to rest on the person. So there's some kind of ceremonial burial, which also indicates some kind of religious ideology. You can go back even possibly past our own species to things like Neanderthals, who we think had some kind of ceremonial burials. This is really hotly disputed in human paleoanthropology, whether or not these Neanderthals are burying their dead with flowers or if this is just pollen from seasonal environments getting in. We're not 100% sure, but there is some idea that there are some ceremonial burials of Neanderthals present with grave goods, meaning that they are also possibly practicing a kind of religion.
How many times, as an archaeologist, do you find the remains of a bones, whatever, remains of a person with copper lights on top? Is that like, how you could tell this guy was an asshole?
Yeah, that was the old version of, yeah, I'll piss on his grave, but they wanted it to last even longer.
That's not necessarily religious, or maybe it was religious.
It could have been, yeah. It could have, like, it was part of the Cleveland Steamer of religion.
So, I mean, is there a difference between being religious or superstitious? So, like, what if...
So, that would be just depend on our definitions, right? Because to some extent, you would have to say any superstition would have to be part of an overarching religion because it's a supernatural belief, right?
Ghosts?
Yes. So, that is why I'm of the religion of Swayze. Which is, by the way, a mixture of worshiping both the possibility of supernatural life and being a cooler.
I pray every day that I might one day, after I die, inhabit the body of Whoopi Goldberg and use that to slay my ex one last time.
or rip the throat out of a bad guy.
Whoopi, why'd you rip a throat out of a bad guy? I don't know. I don't remember what just happened.
What is really interesting is if we start saying, do animals have religion? Right? Because you can almost imagine that the way a dog acts is very similar to worship in a lot of senses. Like a dog almost worships you, and a dog believes you are magical. A dog believes you have powers because you bring the food, you open the doors, you decide what's going on. You are as godlike to a dog as most, at least lower pantheon gods of Greek mythology were to those people.
What about elephants? Don't elephants bury their dead?
So this is an example I was going to use is... Do elephants have religion? They don't bury their dead, but what they do is
never forget them.
Yeah. Yes, elephants are the 9/11 of animals. They essentially never forget. No, elephants go back to the dead bodies of their relatives, and they pick up and manipulate the bones, and they seem to mourn. They literally have mourning periods in which they manipulate these bones, and they make these noises and stuff. So they seem to have some contact with the dead. Is this religion? Is this just memory? We're not sure. But that is a weird religious ritual, going back to the bones of your dead, manipulating them, mourning for years sometimes, years on end. They'll come back to the exact same ones. They know which ones are the bones of their particular related dead ancestors, and they come back specifically to visit them at times. So that's like going to a graveyard, right? To go visit your dead relatives and to mourn them, which usually has some kind of religious significance. So these are all like kind of speculative and going way, way back in time. If we start talking about religions in general, for the most part, we know that early religions, including those in Greece and Mesopotamia and Egypt and some of the things in Paleolithic Europe and Asia and Africa, were kind of pantheistic. They believed in these natural gods that would either bring sunshine or rain or harvest. They a lot of times had very naturalistic features, and they were almost all polytheistic, meaning you had many, many gods. What we see later on is as you get through agriculture and the Bronze Age and large-scale societies begin to develop, there is a push towards monotheism, right? And so now the world is essentially dominated mostly by monotheistic religions. Why is that? There's some really interesting theories on this, and it has to do with the consolidation of power. And so obviously, if you had this thing that you were saying, this is my big one god, and you lived in a hunter-gatherer society. One is, it would be hard to spread that big one god without any kind of priestly class, evidence, or whatnot, because that group next to you, they have a pantheon of gods, and one of them is the wind, and you can't fight against the wind, right? So these large-scale civilizations, they can not only codify everything and say, hey, yeah, this is what our god believes, he's one big massive god, but they can also say, we have the biggest god, he's bigger than all these other little gods, and because you can codify those rules, because you can have a priestly class that emerges from large-scale organized civilizations that can promote this idea, this can spread, and it becomes kind of a feature of a lot of large-scale civilizations, is this idea of one large, overpowering, monolithic god concept. And we see it kind of come around in areas as things like the Bronze Age allows people to settle down in settled towns, and those things get bigger and bigger into city-states. You know, when you look at the Old Testament was written over a period of many hundreds of years from about 800 BC to about 500 BC.
Just as relevant today as it was back then.
Absolutely.
Word for word.
Yeah, especially let me tell you, if I ever catch you boiling a baby goat in its mother's milk, I swear to God I'll slay you right now.
This is a Christian country.
That idea, that monotheistic idea, kind of can really only propagate once you get these big settled societies and a dedicated priestly class to kind of push it out. But once it does, it ends up usually overarching and coming around and encompassing those other pantheistic religions. Because again, if you're saying, I have the biggest, baddest god, he does everything. He doesn't just control the wind. He doesn't just do the rivers. He does all of it. Now your god is bigger than the other ones. And almost universally among these monotheistic gods is, unsurprisingly, a condemnation of people who don't believe in you. Whereas a lot of the pantheistic concepts are like, this is our wind god. And if you were in Greece, you know, you'd go to the oracle at Delphi and you believed that this was the greatest oracle. But there was an oracle down the road at a different place and they did something else. And there were different god temples at different places. And you really liked Athena and somebody else really liked Zeus and on and on and on. But when the monotheistic religions come up, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, every single one, despite what we might think, actually calls for the murder of anybody who does not believe in it, right? So if you actually take those books literally, regardless of which one you believe in, all three of those religions tell you to murder somebody if they will not accept your God. Because of that, now you have...
We meant murder him with comedy. We meant go up on stage and slay. Kill the room, we
yeah,
say. Don't bomb.
The Jews, thankfully, the Jews gave it up a long time ago. They're like, I don't need that.
Hey, it's for Klimt.
So would Judaism then be considered the first monotheistic religion?
The first big one we know of, right? So there's other things that could have been around at that time. And undoubtedly, Judaism probably evolved from another proto-monotheistic religion, right? But I would actually argue that at least in the case of Judaism, it's not monotheistic. I actually think that's absolutely true of Christianity as well and arguably Islam, but certainly Judaism is not monotheistic. I mean, read the Old Testament. I was super surprised when I first read the Old Testament and I realized, oh my God, there's a bunch of gods, right? Because there isn't just one. If you look, Moses, when he goes to go kind of convince Pharaoh of his powers, he's like, God's going to do this thing. And there were other religious people there who are like, my God will turn this staff into a snake. And he throws it on the ground. The staff turns into a snake and goes away. So it's like, all right, so that guy's God is real. He's working. He's doing shit. Moses has a God. And the whole point of the Bible is saying, my God is better than yours. Not that he's the only one. He's just the best one. So, like, there are the acknowledgement in the Old Testament and in the Bible of other gods that are out there. They're just not as powerful as the big God. Then later, if you get into Christianity and stuff, I mean, I don't even need to get into the Trinity to start saying why I think Christianity is polytheistic. Just the fact that you believe that there is a dark lord, if you believe that Satan exists, by definition, you believe in more than one God. You believe in an evil God. That means you are polytheistic by definition if you believe in Satan.
I believe in heavy metal. I just don't know that I believe in Satan.
So all of that ties into everything from society to culture to government. For a long time, religion and government were essentially linked. And a lot of times in our history, in the history of most civilizations, there is some kind of back and forth, give and take, or coordination between the religious class and the governing class, and they kind of use each other. So these kind of work together as coordinating strategies to help propagate culture and civilization. And one of the interesting things about religion is it's one of those things where it can actually help us extend beyond natural boundaries. So let's say we're two warring countries, right? But the people in those countries happen to have the same belief structure. You might be able to unite those people over that belief structure and get them to stop fighting over something like territory or land if they have a common belief, common moral principle, and common religion. It is much harder to do if they have opposite ones. It's even harder to do if they have opposite ones that tell you to kill the other dude if he has the opposite religion. But you could see how, if you are small warring nation states, simply adopting the same religion as the warring state next to you might make you, now we're on the same side. Now we're together. Now we don't have to fight each other anymore. And in that way, religion can unite those governments and then allow a single unified government to go kill the other guys.
And that's why Ireland and Northern Ireland have gotten along so well. They pray to the same God.
Yeah, so you might ask how religion and rationality can be reconciled, because nowadays they are very much seemingly unreconcilable. One of the ideas is that religion will eventually evolve just like it has before. You know, if you look at the way Christianity has been practiced over the last 2,000 years, it's varied. Up until 1,000 years ago, Christianity was actually viewed as polytheistic. So you had a temple to Jesus, you had a temple to God, and you had a temple to the Holy Spirit, and they were not considered the same thing. In certain areas. Certain areas they were. Those areas where Christianity was practiced as a polytheistic religion essentially slowly tapered out or were conquered or something, and that no longer is the case. Then Christianity became monotheistic. Then after, the Protestant Revolution, you have all these different Christianity sects that go out and do all these different things. All of that means that religion is constantly evolving. It was not unusual to take the Bible literally in the 1200s, which meant you could literally murder your child for being disobedient.
I think that's just an excuse people used when they Casey Anthony the kid.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. Literally says here that a disobedient child should be killed. What did I do wrong? What did I do wrong?
That case was tried in Florida. I am shocked that argument did not come out in court.
But we could see how religion could continually evolve. It does right now. I mean, the fact that many religions now in mainstream modern societies accept homosexuality instead of, again, killing people who are homosexual is just the product of the evolution of that kind of belief structure. So maybe in the future it just kind of becomes something that is in the background, or it becomes something that people remember or reminisce about or part of culture. and probably is taken less literally as time goes on. Some people think it will essentially phase itself out altogether, that it's the stone tool of humanity. It was something that was really important for us to get to certain stages of evolution because it helped unite us or give us common values, but we are now past the point where we need it. I don't know if that's true. I think it would be pretty hard to imagine a world that has zero religion. I think you're always going to have something going on, but maybe that's just our weird, biased 21st century viewpoint.
I think religion has a purpose now, because now whenever I see somebody post about Jesus or something, in my mind I'm like, okay, I didn't know that person was dumb.
Oh,
now
gotcha.
I know this person's dumb.
Gotcha.
Thanks, Grandma.
All right, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
Guys, we have a theme for Science Articles this week: female Scottish superheroes.
Haggis Lady's finally going to get her fucking due on the show.
Yeah.
I've been sending you articles and graphic novels for years.
I went to Scotland once, and I can say this pretty definitively. The superpower of any Scottish person is the ability to speak English and not be understood by any other English-speaking person.
In Scotland, there's actually one superhero who actually has the power to be understood outside of Scotland with their English.
That would be a huge superhero power and one that they desperately need. So we're going to talk about the first one, which is the Painless Woman. Very interesting story making the rounds. This is a story about a Scottish woman in her 60s that recently realized she doesn't feel pain the way the rest of us do. Very, very neat.
Like, did a caber land on her foot and...
Yeah, and then she got raped by a sheep. That was...
This sounds like the type of woman who'd be raping the sheep.
So, in fact, this woman exhibits very little pain response, almost no anxiety, and is essentially immune to fear. On top of that, she also has a super fast healing ability, so she's basically female Scottish Wolverine.
Okay, when you say immune to fear, like,
yeah.
I mean, how do you judge that? Like, were the English charging the front lines on cavalry and she just fucking, she held the line?
I have a story about a sheep rape you should read. No, she was like in a bad car accident. She like describes how like as it was happening, she's just, I guess I'm in a car accident right now.
She's run into a burning building no less than 5 times just to save coupons.
So when you say she can't feel pain, is it just pain or is it all feeling or is it a numbness or?
Yeah, it's not that she can't feel pain. She just doesn't experience it the same way we do. So she can feel pressure. She can actually like manipulate objects and feel them in her hand. The same way you can hold something and you can feel it there and you can feel its texture, but you don't necessarily feel pain from it, right? It wouldn't be unless that thing was red hot that you would feel that same sensation, but you would actually feel pain. So she can feel things and feel their texture and their shape and their size. She just doesn't have the same pain response that most of us have.
Is this that rare? Because haven't there been people who have been don't feel pain for a long time? And it's a very dangerous thing. Are you saying?
It is dangerous because they can get bed sores and they can end up getting infected.
But you're saying this lady doesn't have the same thing. She has all the good and none of the bad.
Yeah, she still feels things. It's not like she's paralyzed. It's just that she doesn't have the same pain response. And there have been people in the past who have stuff like this before. We know specific receptors that seem to be affected. It's just very, very rare. And usually it can have some other implications that end up, you know, causing damage to that person's neurological issues, right? So in this case, it's not that. So they looked at her and they tried to figure out what is up with her. Now, the way they found out is she had had hand surgery in her 60s. And came back like the next day and the doctor's like, so you need some painkillers? She's like, nah, I'm good.
She punched the doctor in the face for insinuating.
Yeah.
Because so I picture her as a caber tossing lady.
I do too as well. Yeah, so they checked out her hand and they're like, oh yeah, this seems like you would be feeling this right now. And she's like, nah, I'm good. And then they realized like her hip was halfway degraded and she didn't even really care about it. You know, like it wasn't even a big deal. She has osteoporosis in her hip. She doesn't care. And she just kind of was like, yeah, I never really have pain. And they gave her an anxiety test. She essentially scored the lowest possible you could on an anxiety test. She has never really felt fear. They noticed, and she has noticed before, that her wounds heal very quickly. And funny enough, she also has some weird memory issues where she can't remember specific words and stuff quite often. So
I ain't got time to remember things. Or bleed. So
they actually did a genetic study on her, and they found two notable mutations. One was a microdeletion in a pseudogene. Previously, it was only briefly found in medical literature, which was the FAAH out gene. So FAAH is a gene that we already knew of that was related to pain receptors. It's part of the endocannabinoid system. And we knew that in mice models that it has some effects when you fuck with this gene. It can make mice seem less sensitive to pain. It also makes them heal quicker, just like she did. We found that one, which we kind of knew about, but then also a pseudogene deletion in FAAH out, which is a new pseudogene that we discovered.
What do you mean by pseudogene?
So, good question. Pseudogene is where essentially you have a different variant of a normal gene. So if you have a specific gene that's normally in that place, and then there's a mutation or a deletion or something happens, and now you have a weird variant of that, we call that a pseudogene, right? And so a lot of times in this case, this one doesn't actually code for something. It modifies the code for the regular FAAH gene. These two together work to produce an effect that's a lot like acetaminophen, also known as Tylenol. So she basically has a natural painkiller in her system at almost all times. And what goes on is the system, the endocannabinoid system, which has to do with pain, is essentially functioning differently. She can't really produce the amount of pain response that we would normally fear because basically the way that the system works is it's getting downregulated so that she can't fire those same nerve endings and those same neurons. That means that she is naturally much more immune to pain than the rest of us would be. Are there downsides? Yes. Like she didn't know her hip was going out and it was degrading away with osteoporosis. Totally. But
she can survive the adamantium bone surgery.
Yes, absolutely. And you might think, wait a second, wait, how did she make it this far and not realize this till her 60s? And her response was, I just thought this was how everybody was. Think about that. You wouldn't know, right? Like, the only way you'd know is if you sat there with five other people and you were all just stabbing each other in the hand being like, I rate this a 7, you know? And you just, you wouldn't really come across it. She just assumed, oh, this is what everybody feels.
Did she ever go through childbirth? Because maybe just having a conversation, or maybe every Scottish woman's super tough.
Yeah, that's true.
And so maybe she's just slightly tougher than the rest of them.
Like you said, mid-caber toss. It's actually the same movement, like the same squatting and jumping up. That's how you squirt them out.
She did have the most impressive beard of all the ladies in the county.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm picturing like dwarves or something from fucking Middle Earth.
So that was part of the reason that she didn't notice until then. And I always find that funny. Like it's almost like I met a lot of smart people like this. I met a lot of people in school who were like this, where you talk to them a little bit and then you watch them interact with a person of normal intelligence and you almost have to pull them aside and be like, no, he's a normie. You can't get into mitochondria with him. Like this isn't the conversation to have. There are people who I've met who are very smart, but they're incredibly naive as to the difference in level of intelligence of them versus other people. And they just assume people get the same things they get the first time over.
I think they need to talk about things that their newfound dumb friends would like the history of Mountain Dew.
I just see a Ken Burns documentary on the Code Red years.
How to use physics to create the world's perfect nut shot.
So you might also think, why does this pain reception, this endocannabinoid system effect, why would that cause the issues with the wound healing and the fear and the anxiety? Wound healing, I don't know. That might be a weird chemical thing. I'm not sure. But the fear and anxiety kind of makes sense if you think about it. Think about what this is. Maybe it's neurological. Maybe this has to do with the endocannabinoid system, and that's part of fear and anxiety. Maybe that's it. But it also, in my mind, might be psychological. If you're never really exposed to that much pain, maybe you don't learn the same fear response. Think how we teach mice fear responses in the lab, right? You shock them, and then they slowly get a custom fear response to something. She's like the person who's never been shocked, you know? She doesn't feel pain, and therefore the threat of stuff is not as big for her. Maybe there's also another thing where the same thing that's regulating pain is regulating her mood or something, but I have to think that if you grow up without a tremendous threat of pain at any given time in your life, you would be a much more laid-back person.
Her father or mother, if they were to discipline her, would have to be almost like John Jones or something to really lay those blows to get her to understand.
Yeah, like you almost have to switch tactics. You're like, from now on, I'm choking you out because you might not feel pain, but you'll wake up groggy.
You know what? You don't feel physical pain, but you feel emotional pain just like the rest of us, fatty.
That's the thing, though. She does, like, the anxiety means that she doesn't really. And I actually think that's because emotional pain is basically something we learn to associate with physical pain. Like, we learn pain on the physical side first, and then we associate stuff later on with emotional pain. I think if you are lacking physical pain, it can be much more difficult to learn emotional pain.
That's why every time you insult me on the show, my groin hurts because I associate it with...
Which has never happened yet. I'm still trying to promote you and I call BS.
You
but yes,
son of a bitch.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your propaganda campaign continues.
You'd have to wonder, though, is that a good thing? Like, if you didn't have anxiety and fear, would you be, like, almost a monster? You know, like, doesn't, like, kind of a weird social fear keep us in line a lot? Doesn't that kind of make us more cognizant of the way we treat others because we feel pain and we don't want others to feel pain? Like, isn't that part of empathy?
Yeah. Don't psychopaths score really low in anxiety? Yeah. And
and pain and everything else. Yeah. But I just think about that. Like, and then it also makes me think of that whole nebulous thing of like, we all have these subjective experiences of the world. And, you know, we've talked about this before of, we don't know that your experience of green is the same as my experience of green. There is an objective green. It's a wavelength of light. It has a physical property, but what I see as green might be different than what you see as green, what you perceive as green. In my head, what is green might look yet red in your head, and we'd never know because all we're doing is measuring forms of light.
I could have been shallow-howled by Tony Robbins in an elevator a week ago. And
yeah,
we could
exactly.
be looking at the same person, but also two very different people.
What if the version of Shallow Hal for 2019 was Tony Robbins brainwashing Jack Black into thinking Gwyneth Paltrow wasn't full of shit?
She just sees her. She's a monster. Yeah. Like, oh my God.
No, he sees Gwyneth Paltrow. She's all reasonable. She's like got glasses on. She's just like, vaccines don't cause autism. Like
she's she's at the drawing board curing cancer.
So if you couldn't empathize with other people, I wonder if it would turn you into like a total monster because you wouldn't
but
be
she
able...
made it 60 years though.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, there are
every enemy she's had.
There are plenty of 60-year-old sociopaths, though. So, like, that doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Is she like the Cersei Lannister of her town?
That would be a good question. What do the townsfolk feel about her? I got to tell you, I would feel a little weird if she was my neighbor. I'd be like, it's like the same thing in the medieval period. Kings would get really mad if any nobleman tried to build a castle because, like, they're like, no. You shouldn't be able to defend yourself against me. Like, I should always be able to get you if I need to. I feel that way about her. I'm like, I don't want to hurt you, but I want you to think I can.
Some dogs just have to put down. It's not about teaching them.
Yeah, absolutely. But it makes me think of that subjective relative experience of things. And, like, for all we know, we all experience pain vastly differently. You know, maybe people literally just super sensitive to pain all around us all the time. They've just grown accustomed to it. They experience this horrible pain when minor things happen and we don't, or vice versa.
Picturing Bobby trying to kill his neighbor, this lady, but like she falls off a Scottish cliff, but Bobby can't find the body. Bobby's packing up the house. We have to go now. She heals quickly. We have to go now.
It's a very interesting experience. I think about that a lot. Like there are things that cause an incredible amount of pain, but not a lot of physical damage. For instance, like a taser. Right, Damien, you and I have been tased numerous times, mostly by each other.
We ride the lightning.
Yeah, exactly.
Dance with the spark.
Those of you listeners, when Damien and I were in high school, one of our friends made the mistake of purchasing a taser on the then new internet, and we...
Started an arms race.
It started a very, very dangerous arms race because it's similar to the king who couldn't allow someone to have a castle. It became a need for everybody to then have a taser. And then it just became a daily event that you would get tased. And I remember very specifically when Damien transgressed and attacked somebody with a taser in a way that a council...
I scarred his face.
Yes, you literally tased him in the face, which, by the way, if you guys have never done this before, funny fact, the skin on your face is very different than the skin on your rest of your body, and if you tase somebody in the face, it actually makes them bleed. And so Damien tased a guy in the face until he bled, and...
Which didn't take a lot. I mean, I'm a villain, but it's not like I sat there like...
Yeah, held him down, yeah.
It's not like I attached the electrodes to his face. Hit him again.
Yeah, you like tackled him, and I think he was squirming. You were trying to get him in the neck, and you got him in the face. And so it was determined that the best course of action, the only fair treatment, would that somebody would have to lay on Damien, hold him down, while Damien took a neck tase, which was the most painful tase that we could find, and you would take a tase in the neck for some kind of period of time, like 3 to 5 seconds.
More painful than the face.
I think so. Like, the face is a different... I don't know.
The face, you're pulling back. And yeah. Like, but with the neck... I don't know. Like, it goes right to the spine.
Begs for a controlled experiment.
Oh, we did a lot of controlled experiments. Connor, let me tell you. If I've got a taser right now, I could tase you in the arm, and you would go, fuck, that really, really hurt. Like, ah! And if it was just a half a second, like, boom, real quick in the arm, you'd be like, fuck, that really hurt. But whatever. If I tased you in the neck, you'd be pissed. It is incredibly painful. And the thing about tasers is it gets exponentially worse every second you have it on. So like a quick little boof, you're like, ah. But if I held that on in that same spot for 2 to 3 seconds, you'd be feeling a lot of pain. So we determined that the worst tasing would be a long-term neck tase, and that was what the punishment called for. And so we administered that to Damien. And I will still remember, that was I've known Damien for 20-some-odd years. That was the biggest scream of pain I had ever heard from him in our lives.
I take pride knowing it wasn't a high-pitched scream. No. It was a guttural, like a Wolverine scream.
It also happened to be in the dorms of a college, and people had came out from different floors to see what was going on.
Yeah, I'd like to apologize.
A college anybody, neither of us went to, by the way.
I'd like to apologize to anybody who stayed in the ninth floor of whatever Chico fucking dorm we were in, Chico State dorm room we were in, and how we ruined their night one day several years ago at 3 a.m.
Hearing what sounded like a bear caught in a trap screaming at the top of his lungs. But I think about that because that is an incredible amount of pain. And I will tell you that there are people who, after that type of pain administration, I think would have to, like, I don't know, I'm not quite sure, be hospitalized, but they'd probably want some painkillers or something. Like, we all have this very different subjective version of our own pains, and different things seem to hurt people different amounts, right? So sometimes somebody gets their finger caught in a door, which can be incredibly painful, right? And they seem to just kind of walk it off. Meanwhile, somebody else can get a shot, which might not hurt one person, but makes the other person, like, go in extreme pain. So
I got my ass kicked a lot as a kid.
Yes.
It just for everything at home. And that's, like, the only silver lining is that, like, I feel like as an adult, I can handle my pain pretty well. I'm like, thanks, Mom.
Thanks, Mom, indeed. And you know what else you should thank is this Scottish woman, because one of the things that would be really interesting is learning that we now know the genetic cause of this, but also what it's affecting, this FAAH gene. If we can design pain management treatments, think of what we could do, right? So this woman had hand surgery. The next day, she's like, fuck your Tylenol, I'm good, right? We have an opioid epidemic because people are prescribing opioids for post-surgery recovery that end up getting people addicted. What
we
if you
give them these treatments right when they're going through the withdrawals?
No. Before even the withdrawals, you give it to them before the surgery. They still get anesthetized, but when they wake up, they are no longer in that extreme pain. They don't need the opiate treatments, right? That would be a way, way more effective way to run our surgical procedures. So these type of things, these type of weird mutants, they can kind of show us a weird glimpse into future technologies. You got to remember, a lot of what we do with science and medicine is imitating weird flukes of nature that we find. And in this case, this weird fluke of nature might end up being the answer to this overprescription problem we have with opiates.
If I were to give Narcan to somebody who's not actively high on opiates, is there a downside?
I have no idea. That's an interesting... I don't know if it's got anything to bind to if there's not opiates in your system.
Oh, well, because my plan was just to have weekly Narcan injections because it makes it harder for them to get high next time to deal with. Just weekly, you got to show up, get your fucking... Like, you show up to the public needle exchange or whatever, and bam, Batman Narcans.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some interesting ideas of treatment procedures with that. What ends up happening is the addicts tend to just use enough drugs to basically bind to all the Narcan in their system, and they keep going and they overdose. Right? So, like, yeah, but turns out that's not the greatest treatment for addiction.
What the hell's Batman going to do? He's invested a lot of Narcan. He's a billionaire, but he still has to deal with cost.
Article number 2, smelling Parkinson's. So this is another Scottish woman who happens to have a natural superpower. Really interesting story, too. This is a story about a Parkinson's researcher who was giving a speech at a conference in Scotland. And afterwards, this woman came up to him, and I'm going to quote her. And she said, and she was referring to his talk, and she said, "That's all well and good that you're doing this, but why aren't you doing something about the fact that people with Parkinson's smell?"
"They smear all the dirty peroxide." That's British, but... Laddie.
I just love the idea that she's, like, they're at a Parkinson's research conference, right? So you got to imagine there's, like, 2 or 3 people with Parkinson's at the conference. Like, they're seeing what's going on, and somebody's like, hey, why aren't you talking about these smelly-ass Parkinson's people?
She smells a guy who, like, doesn't know he has it yet.
Oh, yeah, we're going to get into that. So, interestingly, so the researcher's like, okay, and they... talked to her a little bit later, and she basically said, "Yeah, I'm an ex-nurse, and my husband came down with Parkinson's, and I noticed that he started smelling differently. He had this musky smell, and I started realizing when he went into treatment that I could smell other people that were in his Parkinson's research groups and stuff. I could smell other people that had this thing, and it was all people with Parkinson's disease. And so people with Parkinson's disease smell. You know that, right?" And he was like, "I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. I've worked with Parkinson's patients my entire career. I've never smelled anything."
Is this just like one of those bad psychic shticks where they're trying to read the room? Because they're like very visual cues for Parkinson's.
She's like, "Hold on, you got a grandmother with Parkinson's. First name starts with S."
Lady's shaking over there. Lady's shaking. She's shaking. Is she shaking?
So the researcher thought she was kind of full of shit. But basically, they're like, "All right, lady, you think you can smell Parkinson's?" She's like, "Listen, I was a nurse. I'm not bullshitting you. I'm telling you this is real." And they're like, okay,
well doctors
we have...
listen to nurses regularly. That's
they're like, well, we have a way to test this. We have these smell tests. Let's do this. We'll give you the t-shirts of a bunch of people, some of which have Parkinson's, some of which don't. Do you think you can tell? And she's like, yeah, easily. I'll tell in a second. Give it to me. They did this. It's called the t-shirt test. We've done this with pheromones and hormones and stuff before. Not only did she correctly identify which t-shirts belong to the Parkinson's patients, she could rank them based on the strength of their odor, even matching t-shirts that had been worn by the same person, and basically say this person's got early Parkinson's, late Parkinson's. And
that one has herpes.
Yeah, and she only got one wrong. She had one false positive that she said, this guy has Parkinson's, and they said, nope, he's part of the control group. Everybody else has Parkinson's. That guy ended up getting diagnosed with Parkinson's. So she had 100% correct
ratio. She walks back in after this guy, after she finds out, into that lab and just brags like, boom! What did I tell you? It slams the paper on the ground.
She walks into the lab. George Foreman follows her and starts punching the guy in the head. I'll show you to tell her.
That man now has Parkinson's.
Yeah, he definitely has. Yeah,
I can smell it on him.
She finds out that the one that she picked didn't technically diagnose for Parkinson's. She finds him out in the parking lot. So, would you like to come onto the set of Back to the Future with me?
You oddly enough would need a time machine to make that happen.
So she basically said, I can smell Parkinson's, and she proved that she could. They decided they needed to figure out what the hell she was smelling and why she could smell it. And in researching that, they found out she was one of what we call super smellers. These are people with a specific genetic ability to smell much, much, much better than the rest of us.
I was thinking how funny it would be if, like, you give her a bunch of shirts, right? But, like, just as a joke, you wipe your butt with one. And she's like, Parkinson's, what the fuck?
She can smell much better than the rest of us. This is a thing that happens to some people. They're almost all women. It's a genetic thing, and it almost only affects women. And these people usually find the really, really high-paying jobs in, like, the perfume industry because they're very, very good at discerning scents.
So what's the point of that in the perfume industry if only they could smell what's in there?
I think it's like being a sommelier or so to see. Like, you can tell the little eccentricities of why this is really good and this is bad, or you can go find new smells.
Do these people do taste as well?
Like, no, smell.
Okay, because I know they use people like that for taste, for consistency in a product.
Sure.
They need to make sure that, like, this cup of coffee tastes the same as that cup of coffee. Or...
It also helps them be able to, like, find competitors who are trying to do something similar. They could, like, smell out the similarities between the two because they're very good at discerning that kind of stuff. So basically, she was a super smeller who was able to pick up on this thing. So they started looking at what she was picking up on. Must be like the sweat, right? Because she was able to do it not only with the person, but their t-shirts. They looked at the sweat and they couldn't find anything. But once they looked beyond the sweat to these oily glands that we have, which, by the way, have the most disgusting name, they're called the greasy sebum, which is like this stuff you output through oil glands in your face and skin.
I was trying to come up with something, but that's way worse. That actually sounds like a racial slur to somebody in Europe. I don't know who. He's a greasy sebumese.
That's what started the Bosnian War.
It's the Portuguese. They're the sebums.
So she was smelling basically something that was off in this, and now they've been able to identify a mass spectrometry signature of people with this Parkinson's sebum smell, and they're able to kind of try and develop a early test of Parkinson's, because again, she was able to find people before they knew they had it, like that guy in the control group. She can actually smell it out before diagnostic clinicians can find it in you. So that means that if you can get the equipment to do the same thing, all of a sudden you can start finding Parkinson's super, super early.
I'm picturing a sebum. If you're steering a ship and you pass a buoy, there's a guy asking you for change on the buoy. Here's some change, brother.
We'll swim for food.
We'll swab for food.
So they were able to identify a signature on the mass spectrometer.
Right.
So just because they saw a peak on the graph, have they actually identified what the compound is?
No, it's not like there's a single compound. This person isn't producing one specific compound, and most likely they're not even producing a unique compound. It's a unique signature of different levels of the same compounds we find in normal people, right? So it's just a different shade of blue, so to speak, not a whole new color. And she is able, because she's a super smeller, to detect that. And you might ask, well, wait, you said there are other super smellers. She's not the only one. Why is it that she was able to discover this and nobody else was?
Because they've all been wiped out by Flatulence Man. And he's coming for you.
Well, think about it. A few things. One is you have to have a husband who has Parkinson's. But two, she had a nursing background, right? So she started putting two and two together. Whereas most super smellers, their husbands get Parkinson's, they're just like, I guess he's got old man smell. I guess that's what's going on. Don't correlate the Parkinson's with the smell. She smelled him, and then later when he went to treatment, she smelled other people who had the same disease, and she noticed a commonality. That has to do with her background, some of that kind of science training of nursing, and then being in the right place at the right time with the right abilities.
Okay, so she has a nursing background, but what I don't understand is how breastfeeding everybody's baby in town makes her so good at medical things. That was a pun. Fuck you. Like,
oh, nursing. I getcha.
Yeah, it's deep. That was fucking...
Since we've now found this out, what else can we do? One of the things they're trying to do is train dogs to do the same thing. So you get dogs to kind of like figure out how to pick up on this scent, and that should obviously be very doable.
Ain't no rule saying a dog can't smell Parkinson's.
I was thinking about this. Could you imagine? So they train a dog to be like a Parkinson's dog. And then they're like, where are we going to put it? I don't know. Let's put it like in the airport so we can smell a bunch of people coming in and out. So you're waiting in line. And all of a sudden this dog comes over and starts signaling on you. And you get this weird roller coaster of emotions where you go, oh no, oh no, they smell the weed. And then the guy comes over and touches you on the shoulder and you're panicking. You're like, oh my God, am I going to jail? Oh, this sucks. Oh my God. And he's like, listen, I got bad news for you. This is a Parkinson's alert dog. And you go, oh, thank God. Wait, shit, what?
As a white male who's as blonde as you are.
Right.
If I saw the dog coming up to you, I would assume it was the Parkinson's dog.
And it makes you also think, like, this is just one specific disease that she was able to figure out. What other diseases might we be able to figure out from something like smell? Like what?
Crohn's disease.
Yeah, IBS.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the guy's underwear.
Bulimia, right? Because you'd smell the breath. I'm going to guess that.
Well, that or you'd smell an overapplication of gum.
There are already currently dogs that can smell things like skin cancer. So that might be something like certain forms of cancer.
Halitosis.
Yeah, absolutely. Bad breath, for sure. Not bathing, or as we call it, the pig pen disease.
I have to imagine that there's a lot of STDs that create funk.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's
true. Especially more so, like, for a lady. I mean, don't get me wrong, if you had a good ball cheese, mm-hmm. you could smell not bathing.
Right, that's right. And if you guys want to hear a very interesting musical take on that, you might look up a YouTube video about a semi-romantic song that was published in the early 2000s called Let Me Smell Your Dick. That's legitimately an actual music video. You can look that up.
I like how gentlemanly it was. Like, I don't want to do anything to it. I just need to smell that dick.
It was a woman who thought her husband was cheating, or just thought her boyfriend was cheating. And so her method of literally smelling out whether or not he was to smell his dick.
That's why you wash your dick every time, guys. Balls too.
If this could be used to help us find other diseases, that do we know what the mechanism is in the case of Parkinson's for why
no.
smell changes and or why that cocktail of compounds changes?
Right. That's a great question, and we don't. So that's the next question, is what is the cause and effect of this? And what else can we find cause and effect for? You know, again, there was nothing about this sebum that we knew about as part of Parkinson's before this. We only discovered it because of her. That means there could be other telltale signs of other diseases, like we were saying about cancer or something else, that might have effects we haven't even considered. Okay, your sweat is slightly off. The urea in your urine is different. Anything could be different, right? And maybe finding these smell signatures are a good way to do it. Now, it brings up two really interesting points, one of which is, think how many times this woman is in an elevator with somebody who has Parkinson's and she's the only one who knows that, including that person. Do you think she has a moral culpability to tell somebody? If she's around somebody and she smells that they have Parkinson's, does she have a moral duty to tap them on the shoulder and be like, I know we're just walking by each other in Starbucks, but I got really bad news for you.
You're gay. Why is that bad news? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm homophobic. Also, you have Parkinson's.
Yeah. So think about it. Like, she now has like almost a Spider-Man ability. And as we learn from Spider-Man, great power comes with great responsibility. And, you know, does she have a responsibility to inform people of this? It would be weird, right? Because she almost has this private medical knowledge about these people that they don't have about themselves.
And now, cystic fibrosis, isn't there like tales from the old country of you being able to taste a baby with cystic fibrosis? Because
I mean, how many babies are you eating?
I think you just need to lick them.
Okay.
But you can tell a baby with cystic fibrosis because they're much saltier. They're something with their glands, like that's just part of the condition. I learned this in EMT class, all right? Like
I want to rewind back to Damien's EMT class. It's a guy.
Lick the baby. You want to pass the class? Lick the baby.
No, it's just a guy making a margarita and then taking a newborn baby and rubbing it around the rim of the glass.
Oh, you want it unsalted? Put it this way. We have a lot of super tasters out there. Maybe there's diseases that they can pick up. Yeah. We just need to loosen our...
baby salt.
We just need to loosen our societal views on just strangers licking you.
Yeah, exactly. No, I just think it's really interesting. I also think that leads to a second question, a bigger one, which is, we've already said we can locate this in the lab, Pretty soon, things like mass spectrometry will be much easier, much more common, and you'll be able to capture gases and analyze them later. If you're out in public, the same way when you're out in public, anybody has the right to videotape you, right? You don't have a right to privacy in a public sphere. If you're walking outside, somebody has the right to tape you. Now, they can't make profit off that, which is why they get blurred out on TV, but they have the right to tape you. One would expect that somebody has the right to capture air around you as well. You don't own that air. So if you're off-gassing this stuff, can somebody capture that, analyze it, and tell your health insurance company? What are the rights that you have to the signals of your own health that you put out into the environment? And I think legally now, it's none. So it becomes interesting when you start having these things where we can tell things about you medically that you might not even know, but that you kind of leave public traces of wherever you go.
So in the future, will I have to pretend like I'm always being chased by hounds in The Fugitive? I'm going to take the river. I'm going to wear somebody else's clothes.
You're going to need to have like
sprinkle pepper behind
me. But not just that. You leave trace DNA where you go, right? Somebody could pick up that trace DNA and find out that you have Huntington's disease or something else. So there's a lot of these biological health signatures we leave around us that are totally outside of HIPAA or any other privacy control.
Well, if you leave it on a toilet seat in a truck stop, it's fair game for anybody.
You joke, but literally, toilets, right? So you're outputting a shitload of DNA every time you leave a shitload of poo. And so you are putting part of your medical history and information and stuff out there. It'll become interesting to see if, similar to that, the smells that you off-gas that are able to tell certain things about your health might be something that your health insurance company wants to know so they can drop you before they have to pay for the treatment.
So we need Medicare for all. Get rid of insurance companies. I just want the government taking my DNA so they can make alien babies.
All right, and speaking of alien babies, thank you, audience, for coming back for Science Faction 314, where you learned about the origins of religion, how a Scottish woman has the superhero power of being painless and having a healing factor, and how you might be able to smell your Parkinson's. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back this Thursday for Science Faction 315.
Ugh! Get out of here, you dirty sebum!
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.